That's the title of my talk. Okay, my name's Donnie. The lights here are really bright, and I can't really see further than 5 feet ahead of me, so if you have a question, don't stick your hand up, I won't see it. Just yell my name out and ask, okay? Okay, so here's a brief outline of what I'm going to be talking about. I might skip a few slides because this is supposed to be a one-hour talk, and this is a 40-minute talk, and lunch is involved, so I might skip a few things. But in general, I'm going to start by just quickly reviewing what phase estimation is and how the quantum Fourier transform and the approximate quantum Fourier transform factor into that. And then that's going to lead into my discussion of classical post-processing, what that is, you know, like what problem it's trying to solve, et cetera, et cetera. And then if we have time at the end, I'll talk about number three, which is just a discussion of applying these the techniques that I'm going to be introducing to different sorts of hidden subgroup problems. Okay? So, first of all, I'm going to tell you what, remind you what eigenvalue estimation is, because hopefully everyone here already knows what it is. The general setup is that we are given a unitary operator and an eigenstate of that unitary operator, which I'm going to call ket u. And what we'd like to do is find a corresponding eigenvalue. And because it's a unitary operator, it's going to be of the form e to the 2 pi I x. So it's going to be something on the unit circle, you know, relative to a complex plane. And you know, so because it's an eigenvalue, we have that third equation there, that u times ket u is e to the 2 pi I x times ket u as well. And we're going to be given the unitary operator u in terms of a gate, you know, a number of copies of a gate which performs controlled u. Okay, so we don't just get u, we get controlled u. Okay. Now, this entire talk is going to be revolve around phase estimation, which I guess is related to eigenvalue estimation. So it's pretty important that we all understand what phase estimation is, because if you don't get it at this point, then the rest of the talk is nothing. Okay, so what we're going to do, the setup we're going to be looking at is we're going to think of x. So here the eigenvalue is you know, x is in the phase here. We're going to consider x to be a binary fraction, so binary is base 2, so you know, ones and zeros. X is going to be split up into, for example, here it's going to be an n-bit fraction, so 0.x1, x2, and x1 and x2, and so forth. They're all going to be either 0 or 1. We're going to prepare n qubits in the state 0 plus, ket 0 plus e to the 2 pi I times 2 to the kx ket 1. For k from 0 to n minus 1. So this is, I'm describing to you an algorithm for solving eigenvalue estimation. Okay. So we're going to construct these qubits in these states. And, you know, the third point there is just going to expand out what 2 to the kx is in terms of these binary fractions. And you'll note that I can remove integer multiples of e to the 2 pi I from the phase because it's 1. Okay. And then at this point, I can apply the inverse quantum Fourier transform, and you know, we all know that this turns out to retrieve the bits x x sub k. Okay. Now, and that last procedure is called phase estimation. Okay. So here's a circuit that does exactly what I said. You start off with you know, zeros. You throw in some Hadamards to get an equal superposition of all the states from like all zeros to all ones, and then we do these this sequence of controlled u operators on the given eigenstate, and what they'll do is you know, so I've got u squared, u to the 2 squared, and so on and so forth, and they're going to construct the qubits that I wanted. I guess if I point to my computer, no one can see what I'm pointing at. I can use this laser pointer, so I'm going to construct these qubits here. Now the thing with these operators here is I guarantee that I can provide you with as many copies of controlled u as you need. So in the worst case, you can just throw 2 to the n of them together, or whatever, and construct these and perform these operations yourself. In most typical circumstances, there's going will also be provided with more efficient constructions for those things. But you know, in general, for the purposes of defining the problem, we don't actually need them. Okay, we can assume that we just have controlled U. Okay, so sorry. So this here is the circuit for constructing those qubits that I talked about, and this is the circuit for converting those qubits which we've prepared into the bits that we want, the bits corresponding to the phase that we're looking for. And this is just the inverse quantum Fourier transform. I might also have a picture of the quantum Fourier transform somewhere, but that would look like exactly the reverse of that. Okay. So that's basically how you do eigenvalue estimation using phase estimation. Now, one thing we can do with phase estimation, we can think of it in a semi-classical format. Okay. So one thing you notice is that in the inverse quantum Fourier transform, we use qubits for quantum control, and then we measure them. Well, so for instance, here we do a Hadamard, and then we use this qubit for to control a few things, and then we measure it, and then we get X sub n. Well, we could, if we wanted to, measure it right here, and then use the classical result to classically control these control rotation gates here, right? So what I mean by classical control is we measure the qubit at this point. It's either 0 or 1. And if it's 0, then we don't apply these rotation gates at all. So we're assuming we have some sort of physical selection over the gates we're going to apply past this point. But that's sort of the setup we're thinking about here. And if it's 1, then we do apply these. So that's what I mean by classical control. So if we think about it, we can replace, and if you look further here, at every instance that we do a Hadamard, we can actually just measure right there and then use these classical results, so on and so forth there. And if we're really, really clever, we don't actually have to do a Hadamard, we can just measure in the Hadamard basis. And we can be cleverer if we want. Okay? Yes? Yeah, that's it. Mm-hmm. Okay. One thing we do have to do, though, we can't do all of these measurements together, right? We have to do this one first because there's things that depend on it that we have to control after. So we have to do this one second, and so on and so forth. So one thing we lose is the ability to do all of this stuff simultaneously. We can deal with that. So, we start with the lowest order bit, x sub n, and work all the way up to the highest order bit, x sub 1. And again, we use these results to classically control the rotation gates. Okay. So, instead of thinking of this as, one circuit where we're doing these measurements sort of in a cascade, we can consider the circuit that we're performing for each individual bit. Okay. Because essentially, if you look at this circuit here, we can think of these as actually separate processes, right? These qubits don't actually interact with each other at all. This eigenstate U goes in and comes right back out because it is an eigenstate of U. So there's no interaction between these qubits at all here. And we have just, if we perform these measurements in the correct order and do the proper classical controlling, then there's no quantum interaction between these qubits with each other as either. So we can split them all up and think of a generic bit sampling in this way. We start with 0. We start with an equal superposition of ket 0 and ket 1. We do this controlled U to the 2 to the k minus 1, right, for bit x sub k, and then we do some inverse rotation, which is determined by measurement results that we have already performed for lower order bits, and then we do a Hadamard, and then we measure this, and then this is going to give us a classical result, which in turn will help us determine the rotations we want to apply for higher order bits. Okay. So in general, the inverse rotation R is an attempt to correct this phase shift, which is going to be the difference between 2 to the k minus 1 times x you know, x sub k over 2. Okay, so x sub k over 2 is the phase that we want here, because if we have e to the 2 pi I times x sub k over 2, then, you know, performing a Hadamard and then measuring will give us x sub k with 100% probability. And e to the 2 pi I times 2 to the k minus 1 x is going to be the, you know, the state, is going to be a relative phase at this point, at this point here, before we do the rotation. So the rotation wants to correct this by applying this, by applying this phase shift. And what we do is we try to estimate this phase shift using lower order bits. Okay. So I've described to you a general process by which we can try to, you know, we can try to estimate R. For example, for as an illustration, back here, our method of estimating these rotations R was just to use directly the lower order bits that we came up with and, you know, determine whether or not we apply these rotation gates one by one. We can do things that are more general than that. We can try to estimate this quantity better. Okay, so this is the quantity we're trying to estimate, and, you know, there's the standard algorithm has, you know, gives you some way of estimating them, and I'm suggesting that we can improve on that with, you know, by being a little smarter. Okay, for example, we can measure each bit, you know, more than once, and then maybe take an average of them, or take a majority vote, or, you know, something. You can think of different schemes of doing that. Okay. One thing we can also do is something called the approximate quantum Fourier transform. Okay. So instead of trying to improve the estimate, we're actually going to relax the estimate, which makes, you know, less sense, but you know, bear with me here. So the approximate quantum Fourier transform, introduced by Coppersmith, 1994. The idea behind the approximate quantum Fourier transform is that in the quantum Fourier transform, we used all these controlled rotation gates, right? And I didn't actually tell you what the phases we were trying to rotate relative to were, but R sub n, you know, in general tries to rotate like two to the e, e to the 2 pi I times 2 to the minus n, right, in general, right? So these, you know, for large n, these turn out to be very, very small rotations, and they're so small that maybe we can just ignore them, and that's exactly the idea. So we disregard the smallest ones because maybe they don't matter. And we can even parameterize using a depth, m. So say all the rotation gates that are smaller than e to the 2 pi I 2 to the minus m, we ignore. Anything, you know, that size or bigger, we don't ignore. Okay? And you'll notice that when I say depth, it is actually a fairly accurate measure of depth. It's going to be the depth of this circuit, more or less. Okay? Because I'm only doing at most m rotations at any point here. Okay, so, you know, it is actually a measure of depth, and I remove rotations that are less than this amount here. Okay, so that's an approximate quantum Fourier transform. I've got this nifty little diagram here that illustrates that, where I have all these little dotted lines, and you can see that, you know, the rotations only go down to m because I'm removing all the smaller ones. Okay, so that's an approximate quantum Fourier transform. If I'm smart, I'll probably have an inverse quantum Fourier transform diagram around here. Nope, I'm not smart. Okay. So at this point, we can think about, so what are the advantages of the approximate quantum Fourier transform? One, you know, the big advantage, pretty much the only advantage, is that we don't have to do those really, really tiny phase rotations because, in fact, they don't matter. We can generalize this idea, by saying, instead of, you know, thinking of a specific set of gates that we want to apply, we're just going to try to estimate this guy. You know, so all these phase estimation procedures, in the end, are attempts to estimate this ideal correction. So we can just estimate that sort of loosely, instead of accurately. So, which is what the approximate quantum Fourier transform tries to do. And I can quantify my success probability as the probability that, you know, my answer, the correct answer, minus the estimate, you know, absolute value is less than or equal to some threshold, which is 2 to the minus n plus 1. So this is going to be the nearest fractional estimate, so the nearest estimate given that we're only computing n bits of the answer. Okay, so so what's the probability that that phase estimation using the quantum Fourier transform works properly? Well, we should all know the answer to that. We know that the probability of success is greater than or equal to 4 over pi squared in the normal quantum Fourier transform-based phase estimation algorithm. So this is something we should all have learned at some point. And what happens with the approximate quantum Fourier transform? It turns out that if we're using a logarithmic depth quantum Fourier transform, so that m is at least order log n, then the lower bound for the probability of success is actually 4 over pi squared minus 1 over 4n. And the significance of this is that as n gets large, so for any useful value of n, for a useful application, the probability of success of the approximate quantum Fourier transform-based phase estimation is essentially the same as the one for the original QFT-based phase estimation algorithm. So you don't lose anything significant by using the approximate Fourier transform, which is nice because we've gotten rid of a whole heck of a lot of these rotation gates, right? Because the depth is only logarithmic right now, whereas originally the depth was n. Okay. So that's the advantage. So that's the big advantage of using the approximate quantum Fourier transform. And all these results were done up in my master's thesis. And if you're really interested in the wonderful benefits of logarithmic depth AQFT, you can come talk to me later, and I'll bore you. So yes, so that it's not just success. This is the probability of getting the nearest estimate that you possibly can. So getting as correct an answer as the phase estimation algorithm will allow. Okay. That's true. So for example, the probability of getting either the closest or the second closest answer is going to is actually at least 8 over pi squared, and that's something that you can sit down and prove as well. And the probability of being close to the correct answer is high, right? It's just that, in particular, the probability of getting as close as you can is slightly less than a half. It is about 0.4, a little bit higher than 0.4, right? And the significance is, of course, if you do this entire procedure 2 or 3 times or 4 times or something like that, then you with high probability you'll be able to identify exactly which one is the closest answer, right? So the significance is that it's pretty high. It doesn't have to be over a half, right? With even higher probability, you'll be fairly close, right? And you can derive a similar result for the approximate quantum Fourier transform for being either as close or almost as close as you can. Okay. So what I'm going to talk about now is a little bit further than that. So what happens if we go nuts and we strip off even more of these rotation gates? So what happens if the depth is less than order log n, right? Or actually specifically less than log n, okay? So what happens? So as we start stripping away these rotation gates, eventually something's going to have to give, and our measurement results are no longer going to correspond well to correct answers, right? So we're going to drift further and further away from the situation where measuring gives us the correct answer with good probability, right? And eventually, in fact, we're going to get the correct answer with almost zero probability. So at some point, the measurement results are going to are going to cease to give us correct answers with reasonable probability. Now, at this point, what can we do? Now, we know that the measurement results are still somehow correlated to the correct answer in some, perhaps intangible manner, but they don't just directly point to it, so we sort of have to tease it out somehow. So Kataev, in his infinite brilliance, gave a phase estimation at some point based on this low depth approximate quantum Fourier transform. So by low depth, I mean significantly less than log n. So I could use constant depth, but maybe you want like log depth or something. Okay, so the idea is instead of doing this procedure once, this guy here once, you're going to do it log n times. So you're going to do a whole bunch of times, right? And you're going to use that. You're going to use the ratio of zero answers to one answers, right? So you're going to measure. You're going to measure this log n times. You're going to get zero a certain proportion of times. You're going to get one a proportion of times. You're going to use that proportion in order to estimate this this magical phase, right? The ideal phase that we've been trying to estimate, right? So instead of using the measurement results themselves, she's going to use the this proportion, right? So that's pretty smart. So you sample this log n times in order to estimate this guy, and then afterwards, once you have these estimates of these quantities, you're going to combine all the information from all of the sampled bits. So you're going to try to piece these guys together. So each time you sample one of the bits, order log n times, you're going to get, like, for example, xk and x sub k plus 1 and x sub k plus 2. For the next one, you're going to get x sub k minus 1, x sub k, and x sub k plus 1. So you're going to try to piece these together, kind of like gene sequencing or something like that, in order to try to retrieve the entire answer. And you cross your fingers and hope that all these answers are consistent with each other, because if they are consistent with each other, then, slam dunk, you can piece them together and there's your answer. If they're not consistent with each other, well, you've got some problems. Okay, so because you have to sit down and try to work out who's being inconsistent and how they're being inconsistent, and and then you have to try to come up with some sort of correction scheme. Okay, so this is a diagram I just threw in for fun. All this is the phase estimation algorithm. So this is the eigenvalue estimation algorithm with the phase estimation, with all the rotation gates stripped out for fun. Okay, that's all it is. So now I'm going to talk about classical post-processing, because this is where the stuff I've done comes in. So when I look at this problem, or the way I want you to look at this problem, is not just in terms of just sampling over and over in this attempt to estimate this ideal phase correction. You can actually think of this in a statistical way, that there's a hidden parameter inside this experimental setup, and the hidden parameter is, of course, a hidden phase. And we do measurements which have some sort of statistical correlation with the correct answer. So what's the best way of retrieving a hidden parameter given outcomes which have some sort of statistical dependency on the hidden parameter? Well, turns out that statistically, the best way to do this is something called the maximum likelihood method. Okay, and quite briefly, because hopefully people have taken some course in statistics and they understand what likelihood is. Likelihood is sort of like the converse of probability. Okay, with probability, I tell you about a procedure that I'm going to do, like rolling a die, and it's going to have a certain set of outcomes, 1 through 6. And you give me, and I can, I tell you I'm about to roll a die, and you can say, well, I know, a priori that each one of these outcomes has a certain probability of showing up, and that probability is 1/6. I can build a probability distribution of these things. Okay, likelihood's the converse. In likelihood, I do something, but I don't, I don't tell you I don't tell you one of the parameters of what I'm doing, okay? And it's already been done, so you know what the outcome is. But now I want to go back and go through the set of, possible experiments I could have done to produce that outcome, and you want to assign a likelihood to each of those, original, parameterized experiments I could have done. So that's sort of like I've got, for example, a good example is suppose I have 3 dice, right? One is 6-sided, one is 12-sided, and one is 20-sided, right? And I roll, I roll one of them at random, and I don't tell you which, right? And I get 11. Okay. So now you know with certainty that I didn't roll the 6-sided die, right? So it, the likelihood of having rolled that is zero. And then you can sort of work out based on, work out likelihoods for my having rolled the 12-sided and the 20-sided die, right? And you can work out which one's more likely, right? You know, for example, if I rolled 17, then you know that for sure I must have rolled the 20-sided die. And so that's a toy example of likelihood, but that tries to illustrate how it's different from probability. Okay, so the method of maximal likelihood just says find the parameter which maximizes the likelihood given the set of outcomes that we've observed. Okay. So all that is take every value of the parameter, calculate the probability of having observed the outcome after the fact, and then just pick the input that gave you the highest probability. Okay. And that's pretty much what I just said here. The correct input should expect it to have a high likelihood. The maximum likelihood method is optimal in a very specific exact sense. It's an unbiased estimator, which minimizes variance asymptotically. Okay, so it's nice to have a low variance estimator because then you're fairly close to the correct answer. It's nice for it to be unbiased, so you don't have to worry about bias. right. So as long as the data is internally fairly consistent, then there should be then the correct input should have a fairly high likelihood. And if we can find that, if we can maximize this, this function, which I'll call the maximum the likelihood function, if we can maximize this over the set of possible parameters, then we can find the most likely input, right? And if I find a range of high likelihood inputs, then it's very likely that we'll find the correct input in that range. Okay, so we don't just have to find the maximum; we can find a few maxima, for example. Okay, so that's generally the maximum likelihood method. So now we have to figure out what this likelihood function is for the phase estimation algorithm. Okay, turns out that it's sort of nasty. So we can calculate the probability of obtaining a result for a given input and a given rotation correction. So these R sub k's are my proposed rotation correction. These C and S sub k's are statistics, right? So C sub k is the number of times I've measured 0. S sub k is the number of times I've measured 1. Right, and I could calculate the probability of obtaining a correct result this way, the probability of obtaining the observed result, not the correct result, right? Because this is all based on what we've observed and what the possible parameters are, and the likelihood function is just going to be the product of this for all the bits we're sampling. Okay, and so we can sample. Basically, we've sampled each one of these bits C sub k plus S sub k times. Okay. Now, so this is actually a pretty nasty function because you can see that these are sinusoidal functions with like really high periods. So they've got tons and tons of distinct roots. So tons and tons of local maxima, and by tons and tons I mean exponentially many. So we calculus isn't really feasible because we'd be sifting through local maxima till the cows come home. Okay, so here's a nice picture of an example function. So here's where my work comes in, I guess. The thought is, well, how might we find these local max, these global maxima, right? One idea, the strategy that I'm going to use is essentially to try to find intervals where we can bound the likelihood function. By something that's a lot lower than we think the answer ought to be, and then these are regions that we can ignore in our analysis. Okay, and in general, I'll just show you the picture. So here's the picture. So essentially, I define these intervals, and I try to find step functions which knowably bound the likelihood function on various intervals. So on this big interval here, for example, I've bound it here. Here's a very small interval that bounds the likelihood function. So for example, I know if I'm looking for global maxima, maybe I should look at these intervals first. And lo and behold, in this case, it turns out that yes, I do have global maxima here. These regions here, I can maybe ignore for now. Maybe I can't ignore them, but for now, I can ignore them. These really, really small regions here that are really low, like I can probably ignore forever. Right. So how do we find these bounds? So the general algorithmic technique which I'm using is to consider what I call subfunctions, where I take I take only the first k terms or j terms. Right. So remember this likelihood function is the product of n terms that look like this, right? Each of which has twice the period of the previous one. I split it into these functions where each one only takes the first j terms. So its periodicity is on the order of 2 to the j, where j goes from 1 to n, and then the rest of the function, which is all the remaining terms. So the idea is to try to bound to find a bound for the first half of the function analytically, and then just do something sneaky with the back half of the function, where we just sort of bound it by something simple. Okay, and hopefully, and that will give us a bound for the entire function for some interval. Okay. So once we find a step function that bounds our likelihood function, we can find the tallest step and we can try to improve it. So this is how we get try to improve our step function until the point where we can actually find a global maximum. So we find the tallest step, try to improve the bounds there. If it's a tight bound, then we found a maximum, right? And if it's not a tight bound, then we ought to be able to, for example, so each step function comes from some division of our likelihood function into a front part, which we try to analyze analytically, and a back part, which we just sort of try to throw under the table somehow. If we put more terms in the front part, then we get a better estimate. So this is how we're going to improve our step function. Okay. Now, this is a slide about an algorithmic slide that does some bookkeeping stuff. What I'm actually going to do, because I'm sort of running out of time, I'm going to show you pictures of this algorithm sort of running on this test data, right? So our initial step function is going to be a bound on the entire function, okay? So our initial interval of consideration is the entire interval that we're looking at, okay? And because it's the only interval that we're considering, it's going to be the first interval that we're going to try to improve the bound on, which we do. So here we've split the interval up into smaller intervals, and for each one of those we've developed a better step function bound for each one of these pieces. So now we've got this little step function going, and of course we're going to take the tallest one, we're trying to improve that, and then we do that. So we've improved it this way, and then we're going to try to take the tallest ones and improve those, and that's what we do. And then we find that these tallest ones are in fact tight bounds, and then we found a global maximum. So that's the algorithm. That's the idea. So you can improve it if you're clever. There's some practical details that don't matter. The big thing that we can take home from this actually is how to use this classical post-processing idea for low-depth approximate quantum Fourier transforms to improve the phase estimation process. So the idea is, at each stage, we're actually getting, new information about the likelihood function. But if we're doing this sort of sequentially, in terms of phase estimation, at each step we can actually compute the likelihood function for what we've got so far, right? And try to use that information to try to improve our guess for the phase correction for the next round, okay? And in a sense, using this post-processing procedure in that context is in a sense optimal for trying to find the next rotation correction for the next bit, okay? And one thing that you actually will be able to find from this is, for example, if your data is inconsistent for some reason, you will find that you have a likelihood function which is very difficult to analyze. Okay, and if you see that, that might be a sign that you should go back and do some more measurements for the previous bit, right? And that might lead to something more consistent. And because it is more consistent, you know, like things work well. So in fact, this sort of interactive process allows us to figure out whether our phase estimation algorithm is giving us good measurements and a good probability of finding the correct answer while we're doing, you know, while we're in the middle of the algorithm. So that's nice, right? We don't have to do it all and then sort of afterwards see, oh, you know, are these answers consistent with a phase, and is this phase correct? No, we can actually do this interactively where we check back and forth to see whether our current measurements are self-consistent in a nice way and whether or not we can find these rotation corrections effectively. Okay? Right, so that's the ideas in this slide, finding these rotation corrections online, and then redoing measurements if something's bad. Okay, and I'll end with this slide because I'll just skip the third part here. So you know, I sat down, implemented this. What happened? Well, quite, you know, I guess the obvious thing happened where you know, if there's really, if you have consistent data which gives, you know, which points well to a small set of possible answers, then the algorithm runs fairly quickly. If you have fairly inconsistent data, which makes you jump back and forth, and you know, like you know, lies to you all the time with bad step function bounds, then the algorithm works very slowly. And so because of this sort of dependency on what data you actually get, it's actually been very difficult to find, you know, to come up with bounds that are better than trivial bounds for the generic runtime of this algorithm. But, you know, in the best case, if you have estimate, you know, for example, if you have an estimate with likelihood of one, this algorithm will find it very, very quickly. If you have estimates with high likelihood, this algorithm generally finds them quite quickly. Okay, you know, in linear time. If you have phases where, if you have data which really doesn't point to any, point to any phases very well, then this algorithm will get stuck on them for quite some time. So that in, you know, that alone, you know, could give you information, for example, about the consistency of your data. So if you find that this algorithm is taking way too long, then you can say, well, maybe our data's not very good, and maybe you should go back and do some more measurements to improve that data. Okay. So I don't really want to go into the next section because I have 5 minutes, more or less, and lunch is waiting, and I'm just going to stop here and ask for questions. Everyone's hungry?